This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code, the irrepressible talk show where we bring you the latest news and guests from around the world, or at least people we know and think are cool. So tonight we're going to talk with Corey Haynes. This is being recorded November 23rd, and we're going to talk with Corey about his life in general, but we're going to focus on the upcoming Global Day of Code Retreat. We'll discuss what the code retreats are and try to figure out how Corey is going to make it from where you're going from.
Sydney.
Hawaii to Sydney, or Sydney to Hawaii.
Yeah, Sydney to Hawaii.
And we'll see just how psychedelic that Hawaii code retreat is. So, Corey, if you want to introduce yourself and talk a little bit about your more interesting aspects, the couch surfing in return for coding, I don't even know where to start, so maybe you'd better start.
Sure. So I worked basically coding for money for quite a long time, for probably about 12, 13 years, and then ended up getting fired from a startup and decided that I didn't really want to have a job again. And so I spent about 9 months, traveling around, basically pairing with people from anywhere from 1 day to 5 days for room and board. And so I got in my little red car and drove all around the East Coast and sort of Midwest. And that was in 2009. Whole time kind of did video interviews with people, paired, learned, paired, taught, paired, produced, did a bunch of fun stuff. And then 2010, settled down into Chicago, into the Chicago area, and began doing a lot of training. And then kind of spent 2011 bouncing between, you know, sort of training when I can, making a little bit of money here and there. And then started working on my own products with my girlfriend. And 2011, I've been moving more into really focused training and doing in-company trainings and also working on my own projects. My girlfriend, Sarah, and I, she's a coder too. So we do a lot of just working on projects here and there, looking to build some sort of business out of it. And we also ended up doing technical advising for non-technical founders of startups here in Chicago, because there's a really big entrepreneurial community, but they aren't really in touch with the technical community. And so it's a very strong business background, and they run into problems, needless to say, not knowing how to hire developers or how to run software projects. Yeah, that's about my last couple years in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's awesome. You've also facilitated a couple of open spaces, if I recall. You did the latest Alt.NET Seattle.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one other that I think I remember. Maybe not. Anyway.
Yeah, here and there. I speak a lot at conferences and do open spaces here and there when I get invited. The Alt.NET Seattle was a lot of fun. That was a good conference.
So, Kevin and John, have you ever been to a code retreat? Have they ever had a code retreat in, I don't think they've had one in O-Town.
You know, I haven't heard of one in San Diego either. They may have had one. This was actually the first I'd heard of it, was when you brought this up.
Mm-hmm. Of course, if I had known it was in Hawaii, I might have found a way.
There's still room. There's still room there.
You can have Connery put you up, room and board. You can do work on Tech Pub.
Is he there in Hawaii?
Yeah, Rob Connery. Yeah, he lives in Hawaii. Hmm. So let's see. Corey will probably explain it better. I can tell a little bit about my experience. I went to one in Seattle that was held here. And the one I went to, we basically tried to, I believe we wrote Conway's Game of Life. And we paired for, what was it, 30 minutes or so?
45 minutes.
45 minutes. And the goal wasn't to actually complete the program, but it was to work within, you know, a given set of constraints, maybe for that 45-minute period. So I think we had one where we used, was it nothing but objects or, mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, write the game of life without using if statements and things like that, just to kind of, you know, kind of like a, not really katas, but More like stretching exercises. But you can tell us a little bit more about your goal behind Code Retreat and kind of the different things that you've done at them.
Yeah, I'll give you sort of the brief rundown of the history of them and why we do them. It came about actually at the idea came up at the CodeMash conference in 2009, and a few of us were talking about sort of why we write bad code. What are some ways that we could bring up some innovative ways to train? And the thought that we came up with was that one of the reasons that, and one of the things that we hear people say about why they write less than optimal code and less than optimal designs is just because of the pressure, the everyday pressure of actually trying to get things done. And, you know, whether you're working at work and you have deadlines or you're working on an open source project, you're really still focused on getting something done. And because of that, you cut corners, and rightfully so, you should, because if you don't get anything done, then you're not really, why are you working? Why are you getting paid? But the idea was that we don't really take a lot of time to practice and just solidly practice software development without the constraints of the deadline pressures. And so what could we come up with a format that accentuated the fine, like writing beautiful code and allowed you to do it over and over again and practice it, sort of like sitting down and doing scales, you know, sit on the couch doing scales on your guitar. You don't go and do scales when you perform, but the practice that you do outside of performance is comes into play and makes it easier for when you're performing. And so a couple weeks after that conference, we had our first one and had about, I think it was about 20 people. And we kind of mucked around. We happened to have a Java applet that was Conway's Game of Life. And we kind of mucked around with different formats and stuff. And then over the last 3 years, nearly 3 years now, there's a few of us who have been very active in facilitating the sessions, evolving the format into what it is today, sort of learning how could we use the format of Code Retreat and the game of life, the problem that we work on. What are the things we can use to practice with? What are the goals that we might have for each session? And so over the course of the first year in 2009, we settled into a good format. There was a couple of us who were really active facilitators and doing a lot of them. There was a guy named Alex over in Romania who was experimenting with the format as well as alongside me. And we ended up at the format of 45-minute sessions, pairing, swap pairs at the end of the session, delete all your code. And so every 45 minutes, you get to start fresh with a whole new, I mean, it's the same problem, but you get to start fresh from the beginning. And the idea is that you can't really finish the problem in the 45-minute session. So the pressure to complete it goes away. And instead, you can focus on sort of the small techniques. We really emphasize working on practicing better techniques around test-driven development, four rules of simple design, just sort of understanding your language a little bit better. And it's been going on for about, nearly 3 years since the first one. And probably about a year and a half, 2 years where we've really settled in on, okay, this is the format. Now let's figure out how best to learn from it.
That whole idea about deleting code every 45 minutes, I watched there's a video on the Code Retreat site where you, I really picked that up when you were talking about that. And you're like, this may be scary to you, but you know, thinking about it more, that just sounds so refreshing. And the whole idea of, because whenever I work on a project and most projects, when I finish them, I think if I had that to do over again, I would have thrown out the data access layer. I would have done this different, you know what I mean? And there's so many, and I've had that chance maybe twice in my, 15 years of development. I've had maybe the chance to redo essentially the same project, and it's been so refreshing. And so the idea to do that multiple times in a day just sounds really fun.
Yeah, and an interesting thing is I know people who have picked up a little bit of a habit of they'll work on something for, say, an hour and a half, 2 hours at work, and then they'll throw away what they just did. Basically, everything they do starts with a spike. And then those 2 hours that you've used to sort of figure out and kind of experiment with a design, you can pretty much reproduce it in a better fashion in, I don't know, half an hour. I mean, we've, a lot, you know, I've had that experience where you spend time figuring it out and then, oh man, if you lose it or accidentally get rid of it and then go, oh wow, it only took me half an hour and it's actually better.
Yep. So the whole idea, I mean, you're talking about this game of life. I mean, is there a visual output? Are you having, I think I picked up from your site that you're not, it's use whatever language you want. I mean, are people doing something visual or are they just writing? I mean, what do they have? Hopefully, what are they working towards in that 45 minutes?
It's mostly, there's very little visual output since in the 45 minutes, the UI portion of it has some interesting characteristics and some interesting problems around it, but not as many as the sort of the guts of the system. And so because we're not trying to complete the program and get it sort of fully functional, then you can go in and say, okay, well, I want to work on the rule system and really focus on building a really great design for the rule system. And when I facilitate it, I emphasize the four rules of simple design and the idea that, you know, there's no real such thing as good design. There's only better design. And better design is easier to change. And that's always my definition. And since I'm the one usually standing up in front of the room at Code Retreat, I get to make my own definition for it. And so what we do is we focus very hard on how do you build, say, the rule system such that it's very easy to change if some unknown change comes in. So whether it's number of rules or the type of rules or the little parts of each rule, it's not about building the system to be like extensible and have all of these extension points. It's really about making it so that when a change does come in, you can adapt quickly and actually change your system. And so we focus on these small things. We might focus on looking and understanding duplication. So we might go into one of the common duplication problems in the system is letting the topology of the board seep out throughout your system, passing around X, Y everywhere. And so we'll really focus on how do you isolate the knowledge of your topology so that if you did need to change from, say, two dimensions to three dimensions, or it's no longer unbounded, it's bounded on one side, you could easily do that and cheaply do that and quickly do that while still maintaining a good, solid design. So that's kind of what we go through.
So we had an interesting Twitter question. What was the most interesting starting point you've seen for the game of life?
I guess there's a couple different places that most everybody starts. Like I did one on Sunday at 8th Light right after SCNA, the Software Craftsmanship North America conference here in Chicago, and actually calculated it that I think I've seen like, I don't know, 1600 or 1700 pairs start and attempt this problem. And there's about, I think, three or four or five different starting points that people take at. The most interesting one that I like some people will go from a grid, some people will start with a cell, some people start with rules. The thing I really like is when people start at sort of the very high level. And it's one of the exercises and constraints that I bring in is this idea of programming by wishful thinking, where you kind of start at the outside and just spend the entire time going, man, it would be awesome if I had a method that did this. And just assuming that you have that method and then working around the rest of the system as though you have that method. And then when it comes time, you start working on that method and go, man, this method would be really easy to implement if I had a method that did this and a method that did that. And so you just sort of build up your system from the, you know, some people call it outside in development, but you can do it sort of in, you know, middle of your system as well. You could just start at the rule system and go, man, I could run these rules so well if I had, you know, an easy method that I could just pass it a list of rules and it applied every single one of them, or it applied some of them until I found it. So that's kind of the best starting point, the most interesting starting point I see people do. And it's usually in the afternoon. The mornings are people start with grids and cells and they're it's very common to take the rules and, you know, most of us came up through sort of learning about OO through the 90s, where it was go find your nouns and those are your classes, and then go find the verbs and try to shoehorn those onto your nouns somehow. And so, especially in the morning at Code Retreat, people tend to start there because that's sort of our default fallback on when we are building systems. And so the afternoon, you start seeing more interesting things. Functional stuff is fun. A few people, you know, I start to see a little bit more closure coming in. I got a really fun opportunity to do a session with a guy named Tracy Harms, who does J, which was awesome. They say J is APL for people with regular keyboards. And it was a lot of fun doing it. I think they call it a vector language. It was a really fun one. That was probably the absolute best one I've seen.
So you already kind of started into that. What's kind of the breakdown? You see it, I'm assuming, you know, a lot of people are OO. I mean, are you seeing more, you know, JavaScript? And I mean, what do people use?
There's a lot more JavaScript coming in. It sort of depends on the community that sort of organizes the Code Retreat. So I'll go places where there's a lot of Java, and I'll go places where there's lots of Ruby. I don't see a lot of C Sharp at them. They tend to be Java if they're working in one of those languages. A lot of Ruby, a lot more JavaScript these days of coming. It's such a fun language. Mm-hmm. So people are doing that a lot now and practicing.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking that the JavaScript ones would be easier from the standpoint of people generally can get around them in the language pretty easy. And, you know, it's installed on every computer. So no matter what they brought, you know, they don't have to go through the usual kind of, oh, I need to download Ruby. Oh, no, I've got the wrong, you know, gem, or I've got the wrong, you know, version of Ruby, or I've got to go get Java or set up a REPL, or, you know, yada, yada, yada. There's always something that kind of, when you start to do these kind of hackathons, not that this is a hackathon, but mm-hmm. It's kind of like the old, when you used to set up network games.
Yeah.
On like your, the first hour was always trying to get everyone, you know, with the right version of the video driver, network driver, get everyone's IPs all set up and trying to coordinate all that. And then you had, you know, that's why they always went so late.
Then it's time for circle time.
Spent all this time trying to set up. Yeah. And then you're done.
Yeah. Yeah. We used to run into that at the very beginning, but now we're pretty good at, you know, letting people know when they're coming that you should have a development environment set up that you're comfortable in. And, you know, because we're working on something very fundamental and we're working on just sort of practicing the basic techniques that are important for software development, there's not a lot of setup that you have to have. So, you know, it doesn't matter what version of Ruby you have, as long as you've got some testing framework. I've even had people not have a testing framework, and so I sit there and say, well, all you need for testing is a method called assert, and it's two lines long. And so you'll write assert real quick, and then they'll chug away with that. And because we're all pairing, if people want to try out a new language that they don't have installed on their machine, there's probably somebody at the Code Retreat who has that language installed. And so we just pair up and say, okay, after the first session, people realize just how short of a time 45 minutes is. So if they spend it, and we tell everybody this, if you spend it setting up an environment, you kind of lost the value for that session. So we do a survey of the languages at the beginning of the day so people can kind of see what, oh man, I'd really like to try, you know, whatever, I'd like to try Haskell. And somebody happens to have Haskell set up. If they don't, then we just say, you know, at lunch, if you want to try to get it set up, but don't fool around too much.
Because that's usually the first thing that happens anytime developers start to work on an open source project. They go and they have to get all of their favorite tools and frameworks and whatever else kind of set up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like that, but it used to be like that, but we've gotten it pretty good where we let people know that, you know, you need to come with something set up. And if they don't have something, we just pair them with somebody on another machine. And if you, you know, say if you're in Ruby and you really like RSpec, but the person you're working with doesn't have it installed and you don't have a network to install it or something, which happens sometimes. Just use test unit. Don't be a, you know, you're not working on practicing RSpec tricks or test unit tricks or in unit tricks or anything like that. You're really working on the fundamentals of software design and TDD. And though for those things, you don't need anything more.
So what are some of the common things you see emerge from these? Like you said, people kind of move from, you know, an over-focus on OO principles at the beginning of the day. Are there other kind of like common things you just see, patterns you see over and over, people learning the same sort of thing through going through these exercises?
Yeah, one of the really common things that people come out of it with is that they thought they knew what it meant to do TDD. But we'll kind of push through and talk about the difference between test first and test driven. And we'll do a couple sessions where we exercise some more really hardcore TDD practices. Since we are working on very fundamental things, and all I really focus on are the four rules of simple design, over the course of the day, we spend time talking about what does it mean for things to be duplicate? And what do you get when you, you know, why do you eliminate duplication? Talk about naming, talk about sort of how the test names influence the code that's in the test and how the code that's in the test influences the design of your system. And like it's interesting because people will start off almost, you know, the majority will start off with like a two-dimensional array for the 2D grid. And very rapidly you realize that that doesn't work if you have an infinite grid. And so they'll start experimenting with different patterns for how do you model living cells and locations and relationships between things if you can't store them in one of the, you know, in a set like grid data structure. That's a fun one. And it really is just about, it's about duplication. It's about getting better at naming things and really sort of understanding that. So, and I always press people on TDD.
The thing that I thought was the most interesting was the one I went to, I think we stuck with Ruby mostly, but it was getting to pair with a variety of skill levels. So some people were really good at Ruby. Some people were just starting. And I was kind of in the, at that time I was kind of in the, my Ruby is as good as my Spanish. I can kind of read and understand a lot of it. And if I need to, I can find the bathroom in Ruby in Mexico. But past that, you know, I'm kind of, you know, I'm still writing idiomatic kind of C# or JavaScript just using Ruby syntax. And so it was fun to pair with people that, you know, had just installed Ruby that morning on the way there. I think there was one guy like that. And then some people who programmed Ruby for a living and were doing it before Ruby was cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is something to come into a day and be, and pair with six different people through the course of the day. You get a lot of different viewpoints. You get a good understanding of how knowledge spreads through a team if you're pairing very, you know, if you're doing a more strict promiscuous pairing style. And yeah, and it's one of the things when I was traveling and, you know, working with people for a day to 5 days, I would go one place and I would learn something. And then the next day I would be at a different place teaching it. And just that ability or just that need to be able to teach things that you just learned, really solidifies it in your mind. And on a code retreat, you end up doing that constantly as you're switching pairs every 45 minutes. You know, some people know more than you. Some people don't, like you said.
And you kind of learn from both ends of the spectrum. So the mm-hmm. people that know maybe less than you end up, you know, approaching the problem in a fresh way that you'd never thought of before because, you know, these are the standard ways we solve these kinds of problems. And mm-hmm. then the people that maybe know more than you, they've like, oh, I've seen this before. This is how we did it once before. And so it was really humbling to, you know, you got your experienced dev, so you go in there, you think, okay, Conway's game of life, that's pretty easy. And then they put these constraints on them, and you're pairing with someone you don't know who, you know, has a different level of skill, different level of familiarity with the game of life, and he comes up with an approach that you're like, oh, that's great. Let's try that.
Yep.
We had a question from Stephen Proctor over Twitter. Actually, we had we had three questions from Stephen Proctor over Twitter. He was launching a denial of service attack. But one of the questions I thought was pretty cool was he said, both the times he's attended at SCNA and you've presented, how many times have you gotten to sit and pair? And I mean, you do a lot of these. Are you able to be involved, or do you kind of spend your whole time facilitating?
I spend my whole time facilitating. One of the core things about the facilitator role is that you don't sit down and pair. Your job is to go around, sort of see what people are doing, spread a little bit of knowledge, spread a little bit of chaos, run, you know, if you're involved in the sessions as on a coding level, then when the retrospectives happen in the, you know, every 45 minutes, we have a brief little discussion about what people were doing and the facilitator introduces an idea for the next session. If you're busy coding, then you don't have an idea of what would be a good session or what would be a good exercise for the next session, because you don't know what people are getting, where they're at. So I think I paired at the first couple in 2009, while we were still kind of figuring out the facilitator role hadn't really been well-defined. And then I got to pair at one this January. We had a sort of a two-year anniversary one. And so I sat and I paired with a few people on that one. I didn't facilitate that one. I just went and coded. And that's when I got to work with Tracy and Jay. So all in all, I think I've actually paired at a code retreat at maybe, I don't know, four code retreats. And very rapidly, I moved into the facilitator role and worked, you know, used that as a real good guide to help define the format and learn what's the best way to use the format to be most effective during the day. So no, I keep wanting to go and participate in one because it's a fun problem and there's a lot of really fun things to do with it. But alas, I'm always the facilitator, never the facilitated.
I'm curious, since you focus a lot on pairing, is that something that people that come to these things are used to, or is it generally new to them? And also, you know, how much do you focus on, if at all, the actual act of pairing and how to do good pairing and what it means to be good, you know, to do pairing?
So some code retreats and some that I've done, you know, they're at places where everybody's kind of used to pairing, but I would say that the majority of people who come don't have a lot of experience with pairing. And so they'll, you know, you'll sit down. I always try to be at a place where you can have two live input devices. Cause I find that to be a much easier flow for, pairing, especially if you're a beginner. And yeah, it's just a matter of, you know, a lot of people say at the end that they didn't have a lot of experience pairing, but they really like it and they liked the communication there. They liked the fact that, you know, I remember one where a few different people made the point that they had noticed ideas that were started in the morning looping back through all of the pairs back to them by the afternoon. And, yeah, and I like to do at least pretty much one session on specific pairing techniques. So there's a couple pairing games that I like to combine for one of the sessions. One of them is called Mute, where you don't get to speak and all communication has to be done through your tests and through your code. And it's not fair. You don't write comments and stuff like that. You know, don't type instead of speak. And so the idea there is that when you're writing, we always talk about how tests are supposed to be documentation and they're supposed to express the intent of your system more so than just verification. And if you don't get to speak to your partner, then you're forced to really think about how best to describe what your intention is through your test, through the test description names, through the code that's in the test. And so that's one of the pairing games that we like to do. It's sort of that thing that if you can actually get your partner to write the right code while without speaking to them and without being able to express any assumptions, then there's a good chance that the tests you write are going to be understandable by like future you. who's not going to be able to talk to you. So we do that game. There's another game that I like to put with it, which is called Find the Loophole. Some people call it Evil Coder, where the pairs is writing all of the tests and the other partner is writing the implementation code. And so the test writer writes their test and then the implementation partner writes code to get the test to turn green, but purposefully tries to write the wrong algorithm. And so the person writing the test has to be very explicit and write very good tests that will drive out the design and drive out the algorithm that they want. Why all the while this partner is purposefully trying to build the wrong code, and they have to keep the code clean. So they can't just put like long strings of if statements. They have to really keep it clean and keep it, you know, after every green, you have to refactor. And so it's this game of how can you write tests that are really explicit about what it is that you want? And then you couple that with mute, where you can't talk to the person. And so it brings in this really interesting practice of, both from a pairing perspective and from a sort of communication perspective.
I think a lot of single finger sign language is used.
Yeah, I've seen a little bit of that. The interesting thing, and somebody mentioned to this at the code retreat on Sunday, is that, and I always, when that session ends, when the silent session ends, ordinarily it's like, okay, delete your code, stand up, all of that. And when the silent session ends, I always just sort of let it sit for about 2 or 3 minutes, because as soon as that buzzer goes off and I say, okay, delete your code, the room erupts into sound and they're going, God, when you did that, blah, blah, you know, and everybody, yeah. They just have to talk about what they did for the last 45 minutes. So it's a lot of fun. And we work on little pairing activities like that.
That's interesting that you brought up those two games. A couple of weeks ago at where I work, we were discussing kind of the code katas and practicing. And we were wondering if there were any that could teach things like pair programming or actual TDD or, you know, kind of certain aspects of good design. And we were wondering if there's any way to structure a problem that people would have to work on that would kind of lead them to these conclusions without making it seem too contrived. Mm-hmm. And I like the evil coder and the silent treatment games for pairing, because I think that the people that come in that don't have a lot of experience with it, they're usually pretty intimidated by it because they think it's just going to be some guy or gal sitting over their shoulder kibitzing on their code the whole time.
Yeah,
and they don't realize that it's more like, you know, it can be more like tennis. Sometimes you'll have, you know, just a kind of an instant code review going on, just kind of depends how your dynamic works. But as they get more used to it, it's interesting to see how. I don't think I've ever heard of anyone who's tried it and really given it a good try, not just, you know, did it once with someone who didn't want to do it either, but has given it a real try and have said, you know, I just don't like this. I don't want to do this.
Yeah, I've met people who really did. I mean, who really have given it a good old college try and just did not. It just didn't click with them. And there's various things you can say that, well, maybe the partner wasn't right. And oftentimes, if your pairing is just not working out and you're just not being productive with it, you know, there are personalities that just don't mesh. Like I'm a big fan of pairing. But there are situations where, and people who just, it just doesn't work for. But it's the majority of people. That's a very, very rare situation. I haven't met a lot of people who've given it a shot.
So those two exercises you were just talking about are similar to a question we got over Twitter from Maggie Longshore. And she asked how you make each code session unique so it doesn't get monotonous. I mean, those two exercises definitely would keep things from getting monotonous. But she was wondering about that and asked for questions or tips for facilitators.
Well, the nice thing about, for attendees, you can, you know, there's exercises for every session and they're different exercises. So we'll do things like no primitives, no like, Scott had mentioned no if statements, the pairing games, things like that. It's a lot more difficult for the facilitator. If you've been facilitating a few code retreats, you know, keeping that interesting from the facilitation point of view is a difficult task. And it's really about finding, like, I like to look and spend my time rather than thinking about how to solve Conway's Game of Life. Instead, look and say, okay, well, what could I do to make this a better facilitation session? What can I do to make this more clear for people, as well as sort of, I guess I'd have to think about a little more about the way, you know, different techniques and tricks that I use for keeping them interesting for the facilitator. Because, after a while, I facilitated over, I think the other day I counted probably between 30 and 40 of them. And they stay interesting because teams are different. I do both internal company trainings with Code Retreat for, you know, sort of teams that already know each other. And then I do code retreats that are public community code retreats where it's anybody can come and do them. And while those are fairly different ones, it's really about going in and just kind of looking, watching what the people do. And most people have small different things about the way they approach it. So you can focus on those little tiny things. But yeah, I'd have to think about how to keep it from being too boring for the facilitator.
Huh. Yeah, I know what you mean. It's like when you do something a few times, you kind of forget about all the little tricks and things of how you make it work and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But having done just a few things where I led workshops, I mean, I have seen that just mixing people up in pair programming, getting groups programming, like you're saying, that's a huge source of randomization right there. It's always different.
Yeah.
Should we move over to talking about the Global Day of Code Retreat coming up, or do you want to talk more about just code retreats in general for a while? Or?
No, we can talk about the Global Day. That's
So it's December 2nd?
3rd.
3rd.
Yeah.
I think I'd crossed the international date line going the wrong way there. December 3rd, it's coming up. So soon. About how many sessions are on board as of today?
So today we picked up, I think, another city or two, and we're about, I believe we're at around 88 locations around the globe. And so it'll be starting off, we have every continent except Antarctica, and I'm working on it. I've actually got a couple leads to have somebody down there at least do like a session and then maybe do a Skype call with a couple of the locations. But yeah, so starting in Australia, we've got Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane all kind of kicking up at the same time. And then I'm going to be facilitating the Sydney one. And then it'll start wrapping around westward around the time zones. We've got Tokyo and we've got Perth and I think we have two in China and four in India. And it's just going to start going westward around. Yeah. And we had 88 cities or 88 locations. There's a couple of cities that have two, and then wrap around all the way back to Honolulu, where I'll facilitate the last session of the day code retreat of the day in Honolulu. I have a 6 p.m. flight. So I'm kicking off the day in Sydney. And then while they're all going, Skype calls will be going back and forth between the cities across the time zones, everybody kind of keeping in touch. And then I'm going to fly a 6 p.m. flight that lands in Honolulu at 6:45 a.m. the same day, and then make it to the location and do the last day code retreat of the day. And yeah, it's great because we've got Europe is crazy full, and the states are pretty full themselves. We've got them in quite a few different states. And the nice thing is that there's some experienced organizers and facilitators spread out basically through the world. So there's a couple in Europe who have been doing a lot of who have done several code retreats, or not just several, but many. And then there's a few, there's a guy named Jim Hearn in Pittsburgh who's done 6 of them. And there's some people in Colorado. And then Gary Bernhardt's going to be doing the Seattle one. And So it's just going to be this great day of everybody. Yeah, for I think it's 32 hours where there's going to be photo retreats going on at some point in the someplace in the world. And my original idea, I'd been kind of contemplating it for about a year now, and about 3 months ago, I put out a blog post saying, hey, wouldn't it be cool if December 3rd, we had maybe about 20 cities around the world all do it on the same day and have 32 hours, and it would be awesome, and I want to go to Sydney and then do the Honolulu one too. And it started people started expressing interest, and then in the past 2 months or so, we've had a lot of organization going on around it, and we've got sponsors, and we're now at 88 locations. It's pretty cool, and there's a couple things we're going to be sort of using the day as a launch pad for. So one of the ideas is that we can't just kind of have 88 locations and a big huge day and a big huge event like this, and then just sort of the next day go, hey, that was awesome, let's move on with our lives. So we're going to use it to sort of raise awareness about both practicing as a technique for improving your coding skills, as well as, I've kind of leaked it out a little bit, but we're looking to start a nonprofit for helping subsidize local code retreats that might not be in a position to have a good company that will give them money for food and things like that. And so we're looking to build an ongoing relationship with some companies about sponsorships and donations, and have this nonprofit really setting up about practice and about, teaching people to become better software developers.
Yeah, and I guess that kind of relates a little bit on the Code Retreat hosting page. You've got some kind of responsibilities already spelled out for existing Code Retreats, things like it must be free, funded by sponsors. And I like the part in there where you say lunch should be something good and catered and not just pizza.
Yeah, I always say pizza's user group food.
Yep.
And not to put it down, I love pizza. But if you're gonna have developers come out at 8:30 in the morning and spend the day coding and sharing and practicing and really working hard to get better, have a nice long lunch with some good catered, Indian food or Mediterranean food or tacos or something you look forward to when you have the lunch. And it really is the community events need to be free. They've always been free. And the real intent is to bring the community together, bring local companies into the mix as well, and have them sort of put a little bit of money down and say, hey, yeah, we do support this idea. Some code retreats will charge a deposit, and then it's refundable when you show up.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll, because if you have, 30, 35 people registered and you have food for 35 people and it just so happens that 15 show up,
yep,
then you end up with a lot of waste, and that's money that could be used or something else. So oftentimes, if you're in a town where you're not 100% sure if everyone will show up, they'll do stuff like that.
Yeah, I've talked to people at other events that have done similar things, because exactly what you're saying, when you've got a free event and all it takes is registering and then there's no investment, it's even sometimes a small deposit of 10, 20 bucks is enough for people to take it seriously and really mentally commit to showing up.
Yeah, yeah. And if it's – and I've done ones where there were it was 20 bucks, and you still have – you still have a handful of people who can't show up or don't show up, don't let you know that they're not going to show up. And then you have a little bit of money to either fund another code retreat or, help buy beer afterwards. That happens.
Right. So for people listening, obviously part of the reason we wanted to have you on before this global day is, how should people, find out if one's nearby, get involved? Also, if there isn't one in someone's area and they'd like to, get something going, is there still time to? Is it possible to at this point?
Yeah. So the core place is coderetreat.org. That's got the map. It's got a little bit of the information. It's got our sponsors. And if you were getting very, very close to the day, but if you can gather 10 people together, you can have a code retreat on the day. So, you know, if this comes out and there's, you know, 5 days left, get 10 people together, get 20 people together, get 30 people together. I like to cap them at around 30, but if you can grab a bunch of people together, and we have a mailing list for organizers and hosts. Yeah, if they shoot me an email, I can add them to the group. And we have a spreadsheet that contains all of the locations. So we're going to be, let's see, so it's a week from Saturday today. Next week, we're going to be starting the really heavy coordination of inter-code retreat communication and Skype calls and discussions and things like that, because it's really about that idea of sharing across code retreats as well, not just individual little elements. So yeah, people can go to coderetreat.org, email me, I can add people to the list. And yeah, they're pretty straightforward to set up. You know, it's good. I usually say you need to have a sponsor for a place and some food, but I would imagine that on the day of, there'll be a lot of little enclaves of people who are just sort of, you know, hey, we got 10 people together. We're sitting, you know, not at a coffee shop necessarily, but somewhere, and we want to get on a Skype call too. The code retreat is intentionally distributed. It's intentionally been evolved to not require a central head of the whole thing. So if you want to do one, you do one. There's a set format. Code retreat is, you know, has a definition. So when you go to do it, it's one of the things that makes it so easy for people to do and makes it something that has grown over the last 3 years so rapidly, is it's very much a format. You can go to the website, you can see what the format is. And even if you're a first time facilitator, if you follow the format, you'll get something, you'll learn how to best facilitate the next time, and people will have a good time and get a little bit better. So yeah, it's and if you want to find out where one is near you, just go to coderetreat.org. There's a map, there's a list, and you can just go register.
Okay, we got, what else do we got? Anything else?
If we're done talking about Code Retreat, I did want to ask about Mercury app.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. That's right. You do other stuff.
I do other stuff.
So what's the story there?
So Mercury app was built, Sarah and I started it about a year and a half ago, and it was based on an application that she had built a couple years before, and we were looking for a product to build, and she had talked about this, and I really liked the idea. And so we went to Connecticut and sat on a porch in her mother's out in the woods and just started building it. And the idea, I mean, what Mercury app is it's kind of effectively a micro journal with sort of feelings overlaid on it, is how do you feel about something? And so what you do is over time you track how you feel about a certain topic, and you can leave notes, and it draws graphs and gives you some tools for better reflection. And yeah, so we've been working on it for about a year and a half. We went through a phase of looking at it and figuring out, is there a market that we could target with this? You know, we tried doing a premium plan for people with some new features, realized that we had all of these great features that we had built and only 13 people were using them. So we dropped the premium plan and just turned it into a donation model for individuals. The whole time that we've been building it, we've also had a team version of it. And Scott, you guys used that for a little while, didn't you?
Yeah, some of the guys on our team used it. Yeah, and it was kind of interesting. Most of the guys that were using it have moved on to other jobs now,
mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things that's in the back of my mind, but it's like step 30 of 200, and I'm on 2 right now.
Yeah. We're actually in the process right now of shifting direction with it and looking at, okay, what, you know, we've had people using it for almost a year and a half now. What are they using it for? What value are they getting out of it? We get a lot of, you know, I get emails and conversations with people who say that they, you know, they used it for a short period of time to make a decision about their job, or Like one guy said that he was thinking about going freelance, so he tracked how he felt about his job and how he felt about going freelance for a couple months. And then he was able to look back and reflect on it and have more concrete information for making that decision. And I asked him, I was like, well, how did it go? And he said, I'm freelancing. And I was like, awesome. You know, so we've had a couple, you know, a few people tell us that they ended up quitting their jobs after tracking how they felt about their jobs, which...
That's what you need to partner with, a job board.
Monster.com. Yeah, there you go.
Mercury Jobs.
Yeah. So we what we're doing now with it is we're opening up an API, and Sarah's feverishly learning how to build iPhone applications. And we're going to start building some very focused iPhone apps around the idea of tracking a specific aspect of your life. Because we found that that's what people use it for, as well as just general journaling. It's because it does this, it's more of a micro journal where it's, you know, a few sentences. It's not one of those things where you sit down and write pages and pages and pages. I don't journal like that, but I found that when I had the opportunity to just spend a couple sentences here and there, I used it much more frequently. And so we're going through a few phases with it, and we're also looking at some other products. And, you know, we're both developers, so we really like just writing code and building things.
I would sign up for shouldisellmykids.com.
Yeah. I'll tell Sarah about that one.
So what sort of, you said, I mean, as a developer, what sort of, you're focusing mostly on training. Are you doing other, I mean, are you working on any other sort of projects right now, or is it mostly just, or is it mostly training and then those apps that you were talking about?
So for money, I do training, and then that takes me away for, you know, 3 to 4 days. And then when I'm home, I do my best to spend the time coding. And like we built an app to do scheduling for our technical advising. So Sarah and I, here in Chicago, there's a really strong startup community. And as we got into it and met people, we realized that there were all of these horror stories of dealing with development shops and getting their products built. And when you do a little bit of digging, you find out that it's a lot of the problems could be circumvented with a little bit of education about how a development process should go. So like if the developer you're trying to contract or the development shop says, oh yeah, we'll get back to you. This will take about 9 weeks. We'll get it to you in 9 weeks. You should stop and run. Mm-hmm. You want a contractor or a shop that says, oh great, we think it might take around 9 weeks. We'll have something to show you in a couple days, and we'll be constantly communicating with you and working. You know, you can see what we're doing and you can adjust it, you know, a very iterative process. And so we started doing much more advising with these founders of startups, these non-technical founders. And so we ended up doing monthly office hours where we have 7 hours once a month, and anybody can grab a 45-minute slot with us. And then we just answer any questions they have, talk to them, advise them. And there wasn't a really good application for saying, we have 7 hours that anybody can grab one of the hours. And so we one weekend said, let's have a Hackfest weekend. And we just built an app for scheduling, you know, for allowing people to schedule or grab hours of our schedule. And so that's something that we're working on. Here and there, we've got another, somebody wants to use it, but the idea was really just for initially for us. And so we come up with these little things of let's build this and that.
Cool.
So, besides the code retreat, do you have anything else coming up soon that, we usually have a pimp your stuff section. But I kind of suggested having you on because we haven't had you on, and, B, I know you had this Global Day of Code Retreat coming up and wanted to get people aware of it. And you know, for the two people that listen to us, I figure maybe they'd like to hear about it.
Yeah, I mean, really, that's the thing that's coming up for me now. I don't have any other big plans than the stuff that I pimp is simply, you know, bring me into your company and I'll work with your team and train them. So that's about the only thing I'm pimping these days.
All right, John?
Yeah, set your sights a little higher. I mean, 88 cities and flying to two different places in a day. I mean, that seems like quite enough to be doing.
I think you're really limiting it, confining it to planet Earth. I think
I'm
a little higher there.
I actually did entertain the thought of, because the people up on the space station, they know how to code. I mean, they're...
There you go.
So I had entertained the idea briefly, but thought that might be a little bit much. I mean, it's not a tremendous amount of work to get 88 cities around the world. I don't want to stretch too much. I'm kind of lazy.
Well, if that's all we got,
cool.
Let's wrap this up. Thanks for coming on. Hope the code retreats all come off successfully, and people learn a lot and expand their minds and you know, eventually just settle down and just write it in JavaScript.
Yeah. CoffeeScript.
No, that's right. Kevin did say that I rewrote your JavaScript in CoffeeScript is the new, I hit the resharper key for you.
Yeah, I saw that. That's a good one. Yeah, cool. Well, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me on and letting me talk about code retreats. And we'll talk to you guys later.